Meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll, and I note that nice new ring we got on that new gavel. Did you hear that?
Different.
All right. Okay, there is a quorum. We have the minutes of April 16th before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any corrections, additions, changes to the minutes? See none. All in favor of the minutes of April 16th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes of April 16th are approved. And I wanted to give a little bit of a rundown of where I see things going this week, but Representative Carlson,
well,
I have a question.
Oh, wait, that was going to be my question. I wasn't sure if we were going to, like you mentioned the other day, have one bill, multiple bills.
Sure.
If it becomes one bill, is it going to be done in this committee or somewhere down the line? So if you could kind of give us a rundown, that would be appreciated.
Sure. Here is the plan. For today, we'll take up the higher ed bill first. We'll deal with amendments. Then I will temporarily lay it over. We'll take up the education finance bill, deal with the amendments, and the plan is to then have those two, like we did 2 years ago, travel as one bill. So we would propose to amend the higher ed bill into the education finance bill and have a education bill. Then tomorrow we have two bills up. We have public safety and we have legacy. Those two bills will travel separately as their own bills. On Wednesday at this point, we have transportation, we have health and human services, and pending referral taxes, and taxes, of course, would travel as its own bill, but the other two, I believe, will be combined together into one bill. And then the final day on Thursday, we have state government finance, we have jobs, environment, and agriculture, and I believe we are, I guess, my belief is that we're going to combine all four of those into one bill. So there would be a total of, in terms of the finance bills, not counting legacy, there'd be four bills plus legacy plus taxes plus capital investment. Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I was talking earlier with one of our staff people, and I was reminded that a couple of years ago then they were all folded together, or most of them folded together in conference committee. Would that be an outcome in the end, or do you think that these will be confereed the way they're being aligned now? And then I guess the other question is if there's been conversations with the alignment with the Senate. I know we would have those, so we would match, and that alignment was often handled at the staff level with the fiscal analyst department and so on. So I would be curious where we are then once we're at the conference committee level and what's going to happen there.
Sure, Representative Carlson. The Senate is only doing one bill. It is my expectation that in the end we'll end up with one conference committee, not counting, of course, legacy, capital investment, and taxes.
But the rest,
although those things could change, I mean... But that's my understanding right now. The rest of them would be in one supplemental finance conference committee, similar to what was done in 2016.
Mr. Chairman, then when would that be done? Would that be done while the bills are still before the House, or would they all be passed on the House side separately and then a single conference committee set up, and then they just get the jurisdiction of all the bills that would be under that conference committee's umbrella?
Representative Carlson, the bills, as I laid out, would pass the House, as I mentioned them, a separate education bill and so on and so forth. There's a couple of ways it could be done. I think just, you know, underneath the rules, the fact that they have passed the House means they're eligible for consideration in the conference committee. Whether we use the Senate bill as our backbone bill to do it, since it's one bill, or whether we use some other vehicle bill, which could also be done, you know, it could be done one of those two ways. And I guess at this point, off the top of my head, I can't tell you what the bill number will be for it.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, the reason I was wondering would be the makeup of that conference committee in the end then that would have rather broad jurisdiction. And then there's a couple of ways that could be handled as well, but we probably are going to need to talk further about how that's going to be handled then.
Sure, happy to talk further, but I think it'll be very similar to what people experienced in 2016. You know, in 2016, we passed three, not four bills off the House floor. Those bills were, the Senate only passed one bill. They were all put into one supplemental finance conference committee, and then that committee did have broad jurisdiction, and then that committee came up with the final bill.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll start with the Higher Education Finance Bill. Representative Nornes moves that House File 3638 be laid over for future consideration. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This year's higher education omnibus bill has a little money, and I'll just kind of run through what that amounts to. There was $1 million unappropriated in the Office of Higher Education. That is now being used for $350,000 for state grants, $100,000 for agricultural educator loan forgiveness programs, and $50,000 for toward the student loan debt counseling grant. And then $500,000 to the Workforce Development Scholarship Program. And the remainder of our target this year is $5 million. And that is appropriated to Minnesota State, specifically for the cybersecurity program at Metropolitan State University. And, Mr. Chair, that accounts for the money this year on our target.
Okay. If you don't have any other comments on the bill, Representative Nornes, what I would do then is turn to amendments. And the chair will move the A-10 amendment. What the amendment does is... It takes $4 million of the money that was allocated towards Metro State for the particular program that Representative Nornes mentioned and reduces that to $1 million. Then it increases the appropriation for Minnesota State. And I'd like to amend this amendment or incorporate an amendment into it that would take $500,000 of the money that was going to go to Metro State and have that go to the University of Minnesota for campus support. And if I can turn to counsel, Mr. Sullivan, if you could tell me how that would be in this amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, to create the amendment that the chair has described, the changes to the A-10 amendment would be on the A-10 amendment, page 1, after line 1, insert page 2, line 31, delete $5,500,000 and insert $5 million. Second change to the A-10 amendment is on line 4, delete $4,500,000 and insert $4 million. The final change would be on the A-10 amendment after line 8, insert page 3, after line 9, insert quotation Section 4, Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota, and in the third column, insert $500,000. This is a one-time appropriation, end quote.
Okay. And so, members, I guess in the end, then, you'd have the $500,000 for the university and $4 million for the Minnesota State system underneath the A-10 amendment. Are there any questions or discussion to the A-10 amendment? Representative Leland.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wonder if you wouldn't mind just explaining why you're doing it.
Why I'm offering the amendment?
Or why, yeah, or, well, there's been now a significant change to the amendment, and I just wonder if you would just describe what you're trying to do.
Are you talking about the amendment itself or the incorporation that Mr. Sullivan just described?
Well, Mr. Chair, are we just voting on the incorporation?
No, that's incorporated.
Right.
I wasn't sure if you were asking me about that or the amendment as a whole.
Yeah, well, I'm asking about the amendment as with the incorporation.
All right. Well, I guess, Representative Liebling, I think that the project at Metro State, the cybersecurity project that's been described, is very interesting from what I know and has a lot of potential. I know it was also never formally approved by the Minnesota State Board. And so I want to leave some money in for it so that we can have further discussion on this in conference. But at the same time, I know that there are other needs out there amongst the Minnesota State system. In particular, and so I felt that they should have some more money than they were originally given, and that in case we want to have further discussions about the University of Minnesota in conference, that they should have a position too.
I don't think so.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
So, thanks, Mr. Chair. So you don't have anything particular in mind for that amount of money that you're now allocating to the university? I've just wondered if there was a particular project or... it sounds more like you're just trying to have some kind of a placeholder for them.
It would be general campus support, Representative Lou.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right, seeing no other questions, all in favor of the A-10 amendment with the incorporation described by Mr. Sullivan, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A-10 amendment is adopted. Members, at this time, what I'm going to do is lay over House File 3638 for possible inclusion in the later education finance bill. And at that point, I think when we take up that bill to amend it into the education finance bill, that would be an appropriate time to have a discussion or debate about the merits of House File 3638 as amended. All right, House File 3638 as amended is temporarily laid over. Representative Loon. Okay. Representative Loon moves that House File 4328 be referred to the general register. Representative Loon, do you want to describe the bill or take amendments first?
Your preference, Mr. Chair.
Well, why don't we have a brief description of the bill, Representative Loon? I think that'd be appropriate.
All right, and I will thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll kind of stay to the high 10,000-foot points, and obviously if members have questions they can ask, I'd be happy to offer more information if required. House File 4328 is the Education Omnibus Supplemental Bill, and it adds $30.2 million of funding for fiscal year 2019 to our schools. $28.5 million of that is for student safety and school security. This commitment to student safety and school security includes $27.5 million in ongoing funding, and funding will also be provided to charter schools and to cooperatives for safe schools, for specific safe schools resources, something they don't currently receive. So for fiscal year 2019, specifically, we're going to provide $20.2 million for safe schools revenue, $5 million for additional school-linked mental health grants, $2 million for physical security audits for schools, $400,000 for school resource or liaison officer training, $300,000 for school threat assessment training, and $350,000 for opioid and substance misuse prevention. These student safety and school security provisions are really a comprehensive package that combines additional resources and more flexibility for existing resources. And we took proposals from everywhere. Much of what's included are things that are similar to what the governor offered, and many members brought forward bills on a bipartisan basis. I think we heard virtually every bill that had been introduced, and we've gotten much of that in this package. So the Safe Schools Levy is a current program, and we are converting that to Safe Schools Revenue. We're adding an additional $18 per pupil for school districts and $18 per pupil for charter schools. And, again, they had not received any revenue for this purpose in the past. Districts, and this is particularly important for those with small student populations, they will be guaranteed a minimum or a floor of $30,000 in Safe Schools revenue. And cooperatives will be funded with $7.50 per pupil from the member districts. Intermediates do currently receive some Safe Schools funding. They receive $15 per pupil, and we're going to offer them a one-time $6.50 per pupil revenue in fiscal year 19. The existing $36, the one that's currently in place, that's a per pupil levy, all paid by local taxpayers, is now going to be equalized at 68.5% of the statewide adjusted debt tax capacity. So that's going to provide additional aid to districts with low property values or property poor districts. So they will not have to shoulder all that on their local property taxpayers. Along with this aid, the bill includes some language to expand the authorized use of long-term facilities maintenance revenue, so more flexibility with that, so schools could use those resources for security upgrades and equipment. Additional protections for our students included in the bill is an updated teacher code of conduct, which makes it clear that sexual contact with a student, regardless of the student's age, is not acceptable. We have stronger background checks that will include stays of adjudication with an updated list of criminal offenses that disqualify individuals from receiving an educator license. We also update our mandatory reporter laws to remove any question or ambiguity on whether or not our educator licensing boards, and those are now PELSB, or the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, and the Board of School Administrators, are both required very explicitly to report allegations of mistreatment of a minor. Other provisions include a special education working group. We align the state's world best workforce accountability system with the new Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA plan, recommendations on including instruction to prevent sexual exploitation, sexual assault, substance abuse in our locally adopted health standards, and additional protections for student data. So I'd like to thank the governor, and I know the commissioner is here today, and her staff for their very constructive input, and really advised us on many provisions in the bill, and to the many members who contributed to provisions contained in House File 4328. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
All right. Representative, we have some amendments, but we'll take some questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Luna, I see on page 81 of the bill, on line 81.4 to line 81.6, that once you do the background check and you do a disqualification, that you're eliminating the appeal procedure for teachers to have. Can you tell me why you're eliminating the appeal?
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me make sure I get the right page, 81.4 to 81.6, correct?
81.6, correct.
Thank you. And Representative Hillstrom and committee members, so for certain items in a background check that would be revealed, or and certain things under current law would disqualify someone from being a teacher, and are not subject to an appeal hearing. Certain things are subject to appeal and could be the discretion of the licensing board. But what we're extending is anything that would really fall under mistreatment of a child. And, again, there's if you go back to page 79 and before, there's a list of, you know, anything, any kind of criminal, sexual conduct, other things like that, that would disqualify you. And so it makes it clear that if one of those offenses has been done by someone applying for a license, they would not receive a license, or they would be disqualified from serving as a teacher.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I'm looking on line 80.24 is where another section starts. Any felony or gross misdemeanor involving a minor, and then it goes on a little bit. I just want to know if those particular pieces then are not subject to appeal as well.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. So there are specific items listed that would be sort of mandatory revocation or refusal to issue a license, and there would be others that would be discretionary to the board. And so those are all delineated in the bill. And I don't know if you had a specific question about a specific type of...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was just specifically starting on 80.24, right, any felony or gross misdemeanor. So any theft of any public property is a felony under Minnesota law. So if you steal a stapler from here, it's a felony if you get prosecuted for it. And so my question merely was, is this for anything?
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. So, yes, and this issue did come up in public safety, and we made some adjustments to the DET amendment. So if you look on page 79, line 0.24, so 79.24, we narrowed it to embezzlement of public funds under section 609.54, clause 2, and that would delineate that it's embezzlement of public funds of $2,500 or more.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the Safe Schools revenue, and I see your formulas, but I have no context. So if you could help us out and describe to us what the need is when you're looking at all our schools and how much of the need is met with this money.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagenius. Well, you know, if you talk about school safety and how we have discussed it in the Education Committee, Education Finance Committee, it's really a broad, encompassing topic, and I talk about it often as an umbrella. So there, it's everything from possibly physical upgrades to buildings, maybe securing entrances, communication systems, you know, some have security cameras, those kinds of things. But probably more of the need that has been expressed and what we've tried to provide in the bill through funding and flexibility is for additional support staff. The need for more mental health counseling has been something schools have been asking for really often, and no matter where I travel, and I visit a lot of schools throughout the year, whether it's a small school in a rural location or our large suburban or urban districts, they are all experiencing more students coming to school with maybe mental health challenges or undiagnosed mental illness. And so we are trying to provide a significant amount of funding that schools could use for that. So we've had school-linked mental health grants that have been funded since, I think, the mid-2000s. They're at about $11 million a year, and most of that funding it's in the HHS budget. But we are adding another $5 million a year to that. And then the other funds, so that Safe Schools levy, now becoming Safe Schools revenue, is a very flexible stream of funding. It could be used for building upgrades. It could be used for additional counselors, social workers, school nurses, chemical dependency, gang-related, trying to prevent gang-related things from going. It's a very flexible stream of funding. And, again, every school is going to get $18 additional per pupil. If you're interested in district runs, and we do have them, I don't know if they're in the committee packets or not, but I'd be happy to tell you by school if you have a specific question about your district.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, to follow up. I accept what you're saying in terms of what it can be used for, and I'm sure I agree with you, but that's not my question. My question is, if you look at all those things that we could fund and should fund, then what's that cost, and how does what you're putting in this bill fit into that? I mean, are we funding 10% of the need, 2%? 50%? I have no since I don't know the big number, I don't know how meaningful this is.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wiginius. Well, I think that's a really hard question to answer. I mean, I think no matter what we might put out in fund, there may be schools who feel that there may still be unmet need, and we find that often with a lot of things we fund. I think this package put forward, and with the vast majority of the funds being ongoing, so they're not one-time money, it's funded into the tails and beyond, that this will be a significant boost for schools. And again, as I've stated, with many of them feeling that they need more support services and personnel to address concerns of students, that this is going to provide them money that will allow them to do that, not just in fiscal year 19, but in the future as well.
Representative Guinness.
Okay. I think maybe we need to understand what the real need is out there. I mean, what will it take to upgrade the buildings to where we all say, well, that you got the job done? I mean, that would be the easier one to do. We should at least have that. The harder one is how much more we should put in support staff, but there should be some numbers that we could have that would help us out here. So in terms of the support staff, I know that students are now being trained for lockdowns. Does this money go for that training too?
Mr. Chair. Representative Wiginius, so there will be some outside of the safe schools revenue, so the ongoing revenue per pupil that all schools will receive, there are grants also encompassed in our bill that schools can apply for, and it can help them with the School Safety Center and the Department of Public Safety came and testified, and they work with schools every year. They are requested to come in and help them do an audit of their safety plan, maybe talk with them about what they'd like to see or improvements they may need. And there's grants for schools to apply for to be able to put money towards those audits. School liaison officers, some schools have them. Some have not been able to afford them or not sure if they want them. They would have that option through this revenue, but we also provide money specifically for training. And this was an issue raised by Representative Dabney and Representative Wills together in our committee that whether or not these officers who obviously have law enforcement background, but working in our schools is maybe a little unique from what they had done previously, and making sure that they have an opportunity to receive the type of training that would help them to deal with students on a daily basis, and maybe knowing how to work and understand maybe a little bit more about how children develop, maybe a little bit about mental health conditions, working with students with special needs, those kinds of critical issues. So we are providing additional resources for schools as well to kind of figure out if they're not exactly sure what it is that they need to do or what's most important to them as they're prioritizing their needs.
Representative Wiginius.
Just the final thing. I am. I hear what you're trying to do, and I would support the kinds of things you're working on, but I have no clue from what you've said about how much of the need we are addressing. So I can't go back and tell my parents that, well, we've funded 50% this year or 10% this year and you'll get another 10% next year. We do need to know that. We need to know what it will take to make our schools, the physical part and the support staff part and the training part. So we have to have some of these big numbers in order to be able to even talk about what's going on, because I don't want to falsely assure my parents, and then I don't want to that something good is happening, and I also conversely don't want to not give credit where credit is due. So we're just missing a big piece of this puzzle here.
Representative Luna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagenius and committee members. Well, I think the best way to respond to you is to say that as part of this package, we are not placing mandates on schools on to where specifically they need to invest these funds. And, again, we had several committee hearings of public testimony from schools and representatives of schools, and each of their safety packages may look a little different depending on what they feel is most important. So I would hesitate to even try to respond to the schools that you represent. I don't know if you have more than one district. I know you've got the Minneapolis School District in your area. So I think they would best be able to respond to how they would invest these monies, how best they could use them. And, again, it may be different than the school that districts I represent, or maybe something in Representative Baker or Representative Fabian's area. So I think, again, that's going to be a district-by-district question. It's how they're going to invest these funds, how far it's going to go to addressing the need. But we have had very positive testimony from schools about the flexibility involved and the resources involved that we're providing as part of our efforts to make sure that our schools and our children are safe.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Chair Lewin, great job on the bill. I really wanted to say thank you for adding Jake's Law as part of the opioid training. I think this is going to be some really good work on that. I did work with a representative that brought that to your committee. I did have a question, however, about, and I think we've talked about it briefly, about the school district rating system that's going to be changing. I know that in my district, I've got three district schools, and very different districts, even in my own county. One is high diversity. They have students that get dropped off in maybe eighth, ninth grade that have never seen the inside of a schoolroom before. And I've got others that have very little diversity, students of color and so on. And yet both administrations are having some heartburn about the changes. And even though I know we've got a system in place now that's maybe not real clear to understand, can you help me maybe visualize what this might look like? And will schools be kind of compared to each other based on some rural similarities versus metro or urban? Will there be more kind of components of how they can kind of compare schools? And is that really the ultimate goal, is so that parents can decide how schools are rated in that area? So if you could give me some direction there, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Representative Luna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baker, thank you for the question. I think it'll give a chance to talk about something that's been a topic of a lot of discussion and maybe concern in the bill. So when I presented the DE amendment to the bill, it contained within it a star rating system for schools, and it was sort of prescribed how that system would work. And it's really to have a summative rating system of our school districts, and 40-plus states have enacted one. And so there was concerns raised about whether star rating was the right way to go, were we using the right indicators in that. And so when I offered an author's amendment when we marked up the bill last week, I did take the star rating system out. And what we have in its place instead is some language that asks the commissioner to develop a summative rating system. And so that our indicators in that, we want our ESSA plan and that to be aligned with world's best workforce, because the schools have told us very clearly, you know, give us one accountability system. Don't give us multiple accountability systems or keep changing it. And so the department had some really good feedback for us when we rolled out the star rating system to do that. And so we're basically asking the commissioner, using the accountability indicators that are in the plan that was submitted to the federal government and accepted, that the plan will be developed using those indicators. And I can go into them if you want to, but basically we're not saying what the plan should be. We're giving more time for the commissioner to come up with that. The commissioner will be asked to submit sort of their draft of that to the legislature, I want to say early February of 2020. and that then the system would go into effect September 1st of 2020. So we've got a little time for that to play out. And then I think it was, you know, we were listening to schools and concerns about maybe how we had developed that specific summative rating system. So I still think it's a good idea, but we're going to let that be worked on by the department.
Okay. Well, members, seeing no further questions at this time. Oh, did you have a question now, Representative Liebling? Maybe I missed your hand. I'm sorry. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on a different topic, though, are we ready
sure,
to move
go
on?
Sure, go ahead. Otherwise, I was going to go to amendments and come back, but oh, go ahead if you want.
Okay. Well, I could wait. I don't think any of the amendments address this, but Representative Loon, I want to talk a little bit about the required OLA study, Office of the Legislative Auditor, and I've been looking at the language here, and I have no problem at all with doing such a study, but my problem is with the procedure, and I bring this up actually quite a bit in different subject areas because, as you know, there is a Legislative Audit Commission, and there is and I'm on it, and there is a process that we use here to decide what topics a legislative auditor will study. And, you know, they're a very important resource for us as a legislature, and the Legislative Audit Commission is a bipartisan, bicameral organization, commission. And the way that the topics are selected is it gives an opportunity for every member to participate in deciding. So all of us, every member of this legislature gets really an equal chance to decide what the how to use that limited resource. And yet very often we see bills that contain where the legislative auditor is being directed to study this and study that, really kind of skipping the process that we have. So I guess I wanted to just ask you to discuss that a little bit. What, you know, I assume that you've talked to the auditor about this and that they have said they can do the study. But was there any discussion in the Education Committee about doing this, kind of skipping the OLA process? And I know you've got an appropriation in here, which is great. You know, I mean, I'm glad that you're doing that. You're adding resources, not asking them to use the existing resources. But nevertheless, they only have so many personnel. They only have so much time. So, you know, I'm kind of curious about that.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling. Yes, let's see. I'll start this way. We did talk with the Legislative Auditor's Office quite extensively. In fact, I introduced it as a standalone bill. It was heard in state government finance, in which case we amended the language of the bill. Really, the Office of Legislative Auditor helped us craft the amendment because when we talked about the topic in education finance, I think they were concerned that we were asking them to go in and basically do an analysis of every school district in the state of Minnesota. And the topic has to do with transparency of funds and how funds that we appropriate to the school district are spent really at each individual school site within that district. So the Legislative Auditor's Office has been sort of brought into the process and has been working with us every step of the way on the idea. The idea came to us from a group of educators. Educators for Excellence is what they call themselves, but it's a group of teachers. And their concern is that we provide streams of funding for students based on certain criteria they meet. So if they qualify for free and reduced price lunch, they receive what's known as compensatory revenue. For those students that they may need more student support and more resources to help pay for that. But there's a question about whether some of those resources are actually reaching the students in the school building where those students are that are generating that revenue. And so one of the requirements of ESSA, the federal ESSA law, is actually a financial reporting of school districts and individual school buildings of their funds, state, local, and maybe if they receive philanthropic funds in that. And so we don't know exactly if right now, and it's our belief that many school districts, when they report things such as teacher salaries, that they may be taking the total cost of salaries and that for all teachers across the district and dividing it by their number of teachers, and they're reporting that for each building. But that may not be what the teacher salaries is for a particular school building within a district. And those things can tell you, can provide some valuable information. You may have certain schools within a large district where teachers that have a lot less seniority and maybe are paid significantly less than more senior teachers in other buildings if they are all sort of grouped in one particular building or buildings within a district. And so this is important information to have, and really enable to be able to fulfill this requirement that's under ESSA. I think it's important that we know currently how schools are reporting this information and what they may need to know or to do to fulfill the ESSA requirement down the road.
So, Mr. Chair, and
Representative Lewin.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Lewin. I don't have any problem with what you've just described. That may be just fine. I just really feel like I need to speak up for actually following the process that we have here at the legislature. And we have an audit commission. We have a way for members to weigh in. This, it may be that this is a very, very important study, and that we, had it been part of the recommended OLA topics, that it might have gone right to the top. I don't know. I mean, that, I'm not debating that at all. But I do think that the process that's been set out for right now to decide the topics for the auditor is one that is a very democratic process, because it is bipartisan and bicameral, and every member gets to suggest and vote on the topics and so on. But when you put it in a bill like this, and unfortunately, as we've seen over, at least I'm observing over my time here, that the legislature itself is becoming less and less democratic, and it's more and more is done and decided by fewer and fewer people. And the topics that the Audit Commission chooses from the member recommendations, it's one of the few processes where everybody gets to really have an equal opportunity to bring important topics to the forefront. And so I just wanted to make that comment, because you may have the best study in the world here, and I'm not debating that, but I just really hate to see us just throw out that, we're not throwing it out, I don't want to overstate it, the legislative audit process is still there to pick topics, but this skips the line. And that's my concern here, that we've got this process and we should use it. And it involves maybe convincing other members to vote for a topic that you've put forward. But, you know, the way putting it in a bill like this, I think, takes away that member ability to decide what the priorities are for the legislative audit. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any comment, Representative Loon?
Just really briefly, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, yes, and I understand your concern. I mean, I absolutely respect the process that legislators go through in the Audit Commission of trying to narrowing down topics and voting. But we do also call on the Legislative Auditor's Office to do things in addition to that, when there's some urgency to them and there's a purpose. I mean, I think they've worked with the legislature on MNLARS and some other things. So, I mean, this reporting of data and of financial data by school building is, as required under the federal ESSA law, is going to meet some differences for how school districts are calculating their funding and reporting that. And so I think because of that requirement, it's important that we have this in. And but I don't take lightly the notion of just not letting the regular process play out. But I think we would have a real serious problem with reaching compliance with that financial reporting requirement that the federal ESSA law plan requires if we didn't have this information.
Representative Carlson, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just get a little bit of feedback from Representative Loon about the rating system. And I'm kind of picking up what Representative Baker commented about the different experience levels of students when they come in. And I was wondering how much flexibility, as this rating system is being developed by the Department of Ed, that they would have to acknowledge some of that in the northern suburbs of Hennepin County and maybe spilling over into Anoka County. For example, a few years ago, there was a large number of students who immigrated from a country where the schools had been shut down for 8 years. Well, depending on how you handle that, if you're coming out with a single rating system, I do know from my own teaching experience, different population group at the time, we had students that came in just like Mr. Baker was describing that had never been in a classroom before. And they were often of junior high or maybe even senior high in age. The building that I happen to teach in, and this is true with a lot of our suburban districts, a lot of ELL students as well. When I was still actively teaching, I worked in a building that 30 to 40% of our students were ELL. I happened to have been a mainstream teacher, but my point is how will the Department of Ed be able to, when they come up with a single rating system then, be able to judge schools based on criteria that would recognize that you may have some challenging situations due to the history of the students, especially if you're getting large numbers that might reflect on the outcomes of any given criteria that you might be using to rate the school. Long question, but I want to know how much flexibility, Mr. Chairman, the department would have in addressing those kinds of differences between schools and population groups that they might be serving.
Thank you.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson. So right now the language in the bill, again, asks the commissioner and the department to craft a summative rating system for school districts. And based upon the state ESSA goals, and these are the goals that were established in the ESSA plan submitted by the commissioner and accepted by the Federal Department of Education. And there are five accountability indicators that are part of that. And so I'll go through these really quickly, but and those indicators are keyed to the goals that are in that plan. So the goals are reading and math achievement of rate of 90 with no student group below 85 by the year 2025. Third grade reading achievement rate of 90 with no student group below 85 by 2025. Eighth grade math achievement rate of 90, and the rest is the same. English language proficiency of 85% of English language learners making progress in achieving proficiency by 2025. Four-year graduation rate of 90% with no student group below 85 by the year 2020, and consistent attendance rates of 95% with no student group below 90. Now, the fifth indicator was one that, you know, the department could choose, and it is one that they would, again, would have flexibility to make adjustments to as well. It's my understanding that they would, you know, they may decide over time that that's not one of the quality, it's called a school quality and student success indicator. They may choose not to use attendance, and they may decide that there's some other indicator that would be a better measurement of school quality and student success. So, we're trying to offer maximum flexibility to the department as long as it's keyed to the goals that have been submitted and that in our ESSA plan, and that this system is key to that. So outside of that, the department would have the flexibility of developing the plan as they see fit.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Carlson.
That's what I'm concerned about is the flexibility. And Representative Loon, when you cite those percentages, if a school site or a school district has a large concentration, for example, of English language learners, it might be difficult to achieve some of those percentages. And that's why I was asking about the percentage. The country that had been involved with the Civil War, that was rather an interesting situation because there had been no educational opportunities in that country for 8 solid years. So how you measure those kinds of differences and significant numbers of students from the country that I'm thinking of came into the north suburbs, there's a tendency sometimes for groups to kind of congregate in the same general area. And so then you'd have large concentrations at a given school site and how that school would be ranked under those circumstances. But I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to express that concern, and I want to make sure that hopefully the department, as they go through a single rating system, will be able to take those kinds of issues into account. Thank you.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson. And, you know, I think you're echoing some of the concerns that have been raised, and that's why we offered the flexibility by taking a specific star rating system with sort of delineating what and how things had to be measured. And, you know, there is within this measurement for student growth. So districts that are making progress towards that growth is going to be noted, and demographic information of the school populations will also be part of that dashboard, I would imagine, as well. So I think there'll be ample information for parents to recognize those differences among school districts.
All right, members, not seeing any discussion at the moment, I think we should turn to amendments. And there'll be some testimony coming up, and I'm sure further discussion. So at this point, I'd like to move the A29 amendment, and I'd like to do an amendment to the amendment, which I've been informed by staff needs to be added, which is page 12 after line 10, insert, this is a one-time appropriation. And that one-time appropriation applies to the Office of the Legislative Auditor appropriation. So it's just making it clear that that appropriation doesn't continue indefinitely. So is there discussion to the A29 amendment with the incorporation? The rest of it is basically a technical amendment that makes sure that if there's something else that is in another bill, that we're not going to double appropriate it.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Loon.
It is really a technical amendment to deal with those things, so I would support the amendment.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A29 amendment with the additional incorporation on page 12, line 10, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A29 amendment with that additional incorporation is adopted. Oops, I guess I got to give this here. All right. Next, I have the A32 amendment, and is that Representative Markworth's amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would move the A32 amendment.
Okay, Representative Markworth moves the A32 amendment. Could you describe the amendment?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. In Article 5 of the bill, page 120, is something called a special education equity aid that was amended into the bill the last week in Education Finance Committee, and actually was a bill authored by the chair, Representative Knobloch. And just very briefly, what it does, it deals with cross-subsidy of our special education part. And what a cross-subsidy is that school districts are mandated by state and federal law to provide an education to students with disabilities and special needs. They're mandated to do that. But the federal government is not living up to their promise, and the state hasn't, even though it is the only inflator, one of the only two inflators in the program, in our finances, it's not keeping up. And so what happens is the schools have these costs for special education, but the revenues are less. And so what the schools have to do, because they're mandated to cover those costs, they take money from other areas of the school budget, which is basically other educational areas within the school. And that's called the cross-subsidy. And so what the provision in the bill does is looks at trying to create more parity. So it creates two separate regions, a metro region and a rural region, and the metro is all the metro schools plus all rural schools over 7,500, and then looks at an average in each one of those areas, and the metro area is $1,064 per student of cross subsidy, and the rural is $835. And so depending on where you're at, it then looks at how far are you away from that average, and the amount of money you will receive is the lesser of $120 per pupil, or 30% of that difference in the cross subsidy. So it's actually a good way to start. It's about $20 million a year. So what happened is that was amended in the bill to begin in 2020, beginning with the TAILS, and then in the dark of the afternoon, it was it was still the afternoon, Madam Chair. So it was, the 2020 was changed with an amendment to 2022. And so what this would do is move it back to 2020 and start this early. Because every year we wait, quite frankly, school districts, and we all know this, they're, you know, they have to take these funds away, and there leads to an increase in student or classroom size. And, you know, it, the sooner the better, and I think it's a good idea. And so that's the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Marquardt, let me first say that, of course, since it is my bill, I like the general concept of what you're trying to do here. But, you know, the concern I have is when I look at the TAILS, you know, when I first looked at my number, I said, well, you know, the TAILS we have left, the amount of money we have left to spend in 2020 to 21 is, according to my calculation, only $9,713,000, and yet this costs $40 million. And then I looked, and the spreadsheet Mr. Marks had showed that for other bills, actually the TAILS amount we had left was $123,227,000. So I asked myself, you know, now why am I off so far? And it was because of the fact that I guess I've been assuming all along that we're going to be doing the pension bill. And the pension bill costs $113,564,000 in 2020 to 21. And so if we adopt your amendment, Representative Marquardt, we're going to be short $30 million for the pension bill. And the, you know, the only pension area, only pension plan that I think we spend that amount of money on in the pension bill, there's a whole lot of different pensions that are getting additional funding, MSRS, police and fire, and so forth. But the biggest one and the only one that we're spending that kind of money on is TRA, the Teachers Retirement Association. And so if we would adopt the Marquardt Amendment, we would not be able to give the teachers and the Teachers Retirement Association the money that we were, I think, planning on giving them in the pension bill. And so, you know, it's my plan, Representative Marquardt. I certainly like my plan, but I also think we need to take care of our teachers. And so I guess I'd have to be against your amendment.
So thank, I agree with you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, if I may... you know, there's no budget resolution, as you know, for the next 2 years. And you're talking still about a budget which is $46 billion. So we wouldn't have to pick or choose from the pension or any other bill. It could come from anywhere. And it also could, although it would be one time, you could take 2% out of the general fund reserve, the $2 billion roughly, would be about 2%. And so, I mean, there might be other ways to do this, but it, Mr. Chair, you had a fine piece of legislation here, and I just think it's worthwhile to take a look at moving it up even quicker.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marquardt, but you have a couple of questions. I'm curious if this impacts little Johnny.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, of course this impacts little Johnny, of course.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Fabian,
thank you. And then I'm wondering, in the dark of that afternoon, what floor of that skyscraper did that take place on?
I guess that's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, I know it is.
Okay. other discussion to the amendment? All right. Well, all in favor of the Marquardt Amendment, signify saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. next amendment, the A34 Amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A34 Amendment.
Representative Marquardt to the A34 Amendment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Last year, in a bipartisan fashion, there was put into the education bill $50 million for voluntary pre-K education or school readiness plus, whatever you want to call that. And it was one time for 2 years. And so what happened is about 59 public schools and charter schools, and that's about 4,000 students, got into this program. But it went started this year, and it will go in the year 18-19.
The year 18-19?
It will go into the 18-19 school year next year.
All right.
But, so.
He's correcting your century.
What did I say? Did I say the century? Okay,
18-19
budget year at any rate. And so moving forward, when it would be the 19-20 school year, there would be no funding. And these 59 school districts with 4,000 schools that went into the school readiness program or voluntary pre-K, it would end like right now. So you're saying, well, what's the timing issue? Well, the timing issue is usually we don't pass an education finance bill until May of the year. So next year would be May of 2019. School districts have to plan and send out notices as far as staff and that by April. So even though it might be another year, in reality, because of kind of how we do things here, we almost have to act now. So this bill would be, and it would be $50 million over the next 2 years, but basically what's going to happen in these 59 school districts that have had this program is it's going to be cut off unless something is done. Now, it can be extended, but I think we should extend it this year because of the timing issue coming forward. And on this one, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask for a roll call vote.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we have a similar amendment in committee, and I think this maybe was even discussed maybe when we did the budget targets. I don't remember for sure. But, you know, and I've commented on this publicly, and I'll reiterate my comments. You know, so we funded the extension of a program, and actually School Readiness Plus was a new program, and we did it for one budget cycle, which means that basically when the next budget is discussed and debated, and that will be a topic for the next legislature and the committee, Education Finance Committee, to consider. And the schools were able to put together their programs with this new money pretty quickly, and I think they can adjust. But, again, it's we have been a very strong partner with the governor in terms of supporting quality early childhood programs, and my strong desire to see them targeted to children who need it most for the maximum benefit for those children and to close the achievement gap. So, but nothing's going to end prematurely. The fall school year that will start in September 2018, we'll move forward with this funding. And again, it's something that can be determined next year. We do have, and this was through the regular process, Representative Weidling, a legislative auditor's report that's going to be released at the end of this week on early childhood programs. And so, and I think that's going to be some important information as well for the legislature to consider and weigh as we have really developed multiple funding streams, sort of starting with, you know, scholarships, and now we've got voluntary preschool, and we've got School Readiness Plus, and then we also fund Head Start, and CCAP is out there as well. So I don't think it's at all harmful to wait on this decision until next year.
Well, Representative Marquardt, I mean, I guess you really don't like those retired teachers, do you? Because your last amendment took $40 million that we needed for the Teachers Retirement Association, and this amendment takes $50 million that we're going to need. I mean, I guess there's nothing in this language about taking it out of the budget reserve or something like that. And, you know, members, we don't set a formal budget target for the so-called TAILs, the 2 years that are out. But we do get a budget forecast for it. The numbers do need to add up. We get great criticism when we don't leave at least, you know, a few million dollars, several million dollars usually on the bottom line. Right now we've got almost $10 million left over if we do the full pension plan, and so I felt that would be enough for any little math errors that might show up. I mean, it seems like normally the governor has criticized us if we get much below $10 million in terms of money left on the bottom line for tails. And so now here we're going to be $40 million in the hole, and the only place to really get that money, unless you're going to cut a whole bunch of pension funds, I suppose we could keep the teacher's retirement fund, and we could cut police and fire and other pension funds instead to come up with the money, but that's the only place to get that money in the budget that we have. So, members, I guess as you're voting, I hope you would think about that. Representative Hillstrom.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to take a little bit of exception with your comments that you could only get the money from the teacher's pension because, Mr. Chair, I think that you've allocated an awful lot of money for corporate tax cuts, and I think you could actually prioritize our students instead of corporations.
Other discussion. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, just as a follow-up, I was going to say much the same thing without necessarily focusing on a given bill, but there are dollars on the table that could be used differently. You're choosing to take a look at one slice of the pie, but you'll remember the debate we had the other night about the returning of $75 million into the reserve. Those dollars are sitting there in addition to the funding that you have set aside for other bills. Now, we did have a debate as to whether that was rebuilding the reserve or not, you know, in terms of how you look at that. But my only point is that there are other dollars that are on the table that could be used differently, and that would be another obvious one that could be used to provide some of the funding. But we had that debate the other night, but it wouldn't be the first time that you, Mr. Chairman, and when I was in that seat, that we brought the budget resolution back and amended it as well.
Well, you know, on the budget reserve, though, I have to say, you know, I think the only time I can recall, other than a serious recession or shortfall, that we've taken money out of the budget reserve was a couple years ago, maybe it was last year, where we gave a one-time rebate to people with their health insurance. You know, the money in the budget reserve is a savings account. It's a one-time block of money that we've got. But this proposal is to do ongoing money, to do $25 million a year, you know, into infinity. And so, you know, it's just not very good budgeting to take your savings account and then increase your mortgage payment and just figure that without any other income coming in, you're somehow going to have enough money in perpetuity to pay for your mortgage payment. I mean, you don't want to, I don't think, take one-time money and use that to obligate yourself to permanent spending. So I guess in, you know, with all respect, Representative Carlson, I just don't think it's a good idea to be taking money from the budget reserve for ongoing spending, unless you're, you know, in a desperate situation like a recession or something, and we're trying to, you know, deal with a true budget shortfall.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just saying that there are other potential sources. When I mentioned that one, it's money that was already taken by the current majority from the budget reserve, and there was money that was left over on the health care access fund cost, or not the access fund, but the health care buy-down, and that $75 million was sitting there. Yes, you are correct. That's one-time money, but it's not money that's currently in the reserve. It's money that you've targeted to go back into the reserve, if I were to use your argument, or I would simply say you've taken it out and it's sitting there and could be used differently. But at any rate, we had that debate the other night. I'm just saying right now that to tie this amendment to one specific issue is really not fair to the committee. There are other alternatives that could be used if the amendment were to pass.
Other discussion to the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, the chair will take the roll on the A34 amendment.
Representative Knobloch.
No.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Davids.
No.
Representative Dean.
No.
Representative Detmer.
No.
Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Representative Fabian.
No.
Representative Garofalo. Representative Gunther.
No.
Representative Hamilton.
No.
Representative Houseman. Representative Hertas.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Yes.
Representative Hornstein.
Yes.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Loon.
No.
Representative Marquardt.
Yes.
Representative Murphy. Representative Nornes.
No.
Representative Pawlowski.
Yes.
Representative Poppy.
Yes.
Representative Torkelson.
No.
Representative Erdahl.
No.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes.
There being 8 ayes and 17 nays, the motion has not prevailed. The amendment is not adopted. All right. I'm not aware of any other amendments, but I do know that we had a couple of people that wanted to testify. Is Commissioner Casilius in the room? Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for allowing me to testify today on the Education Omnibus Bill, House File 4328. Very spirited discussion here, and appreciate it. I'm Brenda Caselli, Commissioner of Education, and I will highlight a few of the proposals in the bill that I support, some items I cannot support, and areas we look forward to continuing to work toward compromise. I'd like to remind committee members and the audience and listening public that we have an overall surplus of $329 million. And in this bill, 10% goes to kids. 10%. Not even 10%, because it would be $32.9 million. And this bill is $30 million. So there is more money in the bill. And I appreciate the target of $30 million. But we could do better by our kids. Typically, we fund education at about 42% of the general education of our general budget. And 10% is just not enough for our kids and what they need. We've heard our school boards talk to us about special education. We've heard the need to not close our preschool programs that we promised to schools in VPK. And we definitely need to fund our schools around safe schools. But it's absolutely an improvement on what we have in the Senate, which is a zero target, which is stated by Senator Nelson on several occasions that she has a target of zero. But it'd be great as the bill progresses and as we continue to have debate, if we could increase the target to meet some of the needs of our schools that would match nearer to what the governor's investments are. One way to increase the target would be to retain Representative Marquardt's amendment to the House bill, which you just voted on, to provide special education funding to our districts with the highest special education cross-subsidy and to provide additional pre-K. Although not the governor's proposal exactly, it's a good start and necessary for equitable funding to contain growth. As you know, it is the number one priority of our school boards this year. And just to help out with a little bit about where you might find the money, you could repeal the cigarette tax, which is, I think, $25 million. That might help. Vaping is actually killing our kids. And I also talked with Rep. Loon about literacy aid, which is $50 million. There's just a lot of ways to improve this target and improve the bill. And even though Rep. Marquardt's popular amendment had passed, it was amended later, and which delayed the effectiveness date to 2022. But schools are struggling now, and they just can't wait 4 more years for this relief. Like the governor, Chair Loon took a strong stand for school safety, and I really, really appreciate her school safety provisions in this bill. She had a lot of the shared priorities of the governor's for school-linked mental health grants, threat assessments, pupil fair dismissal language. I love the auditing in here, SRO training, the flexibility given to districts. There's still an opportunity, though, here for our intermediate to serve our most complex students to be provided with ongoing funding. But I really, really appreciate her standing up and taking a strong stance. And Chair Loon and Senator Pratt both agreed to introduce a draft of a clean safety school bill last week, which is inclusive of many of our shared priorities in the House, Senate, and the governor's bill. Bipartisan. My staff worked to get this together so we could all get to work and get the bill to the governor's desk. He said in his State of the State in a letter on April 9th and again requested in a letter today to get him bills early so that he can sign them and we can get started on making schools even safer for kids. I hope you will support moving forward quickly on this clean bill, HF 4439. After years of investing in our littlest learners, it is disappointing that this bill does not include funding to maintain the 4,000 seats for voluntary pre-kindergarten and school readiness plus that were funded just last year. There were over 6,000 applicants this year for just an additional 1,000 seats. There's also no funding for Help Me Grow, a proposal the governor has included in his budget for the last 3 years. It also does not include common sense changes to the administration of early learning scholarships that will allow or more funding for early learning scholarships or Head Start, which would allow more children to have access to the funding birth to three and for families to have full use of the scholarship funds. The bill also requires MDE to administer the kindergarten entry profile to a representative sampling of kindergartens. And let me be clear that MDE supports the KEP and has spent years improving on the administration of it. But the current funding provided to the agency only allows up to 10% sampling of eligible preschoolers. I want to be sure we all understand that any results from the small sample are not enough to be representative and cannot be used to provide statistically valid findings. Therefore, without adding more funding to this bill to fund the KEP, it will not deliver what I think was the chair's intent and what the legislature is seeking, which is data that we could have conclusive data about the effectiveness of our investments. To fully fund the KEP, we must invest in it adequately, which is about $1.5 million this supplemental budget and about $1.5 million over the next biennium. Other priorities not included in this bill include continuation of funding for our BIE schools. I've been before this body before and the Education Committee talking about our American Indian kids, who are funded at about half of all other kids in the state because they're federally funded. Well, we 4 years ago stepped in and provided equalization aid for these students, but we've only been able to do that on one-time funding every biennium. Well, we have an opportunity now to make that permanent so that we don't have to come back and fight every year for these students to have the same opportunity as all other students and be funded like all other students. It's about $3.6 million over each biennium. No funding for GED. This bill funds $7.8 million in small grants, but leaves out the small investment of $400,000 to build a workforce readiness for those who have yet to earn a high school diploma. This small $120 is a barrier, a real barrier for some who absolutely benefit and hope to hopefully find work. And this really doesn't make any sense not to make this really small investment and remove the barrier for GED. We continue to work with Chair Loon and advocates to ensure our kids are not drinking lead in their school water, but right now the bill doesn't address notifying parents or shutting off the water at its source when it has lead in it. I can assure you that all of us can agree. Students and kids should not be exposed to unsafe levels of lead in their drinking water, and parents have a right to know. This is just common sense, and we should not be arguing about it. The cuts to MDE's operating budget by $2 million in the next biennium is debilitating, would cripple our new accountability work and negatively impact our support to schools, just at a time when we're doubling down on accountability and support to schools. This would serve as a huge blow to the agency and the teachers and school leaders depending on us for assistance and support. Additionally, the governor made clear before and in his letter today that with the $329 million surplus, cuts to agencies are entirely unwarranted and he will not sign bills with cuts to agencies. The agency would struggle on its core mission to enact the laws this body has passed and all the new unfunded mandates such as doubling school audits, new grant administration, and curriculum reviews. It just can't be done. We're already short-staffed. The cuts to our MCA assessments for opt-out will negatively impact our ability to administer our state tests. We have gone several years now without any test hiccups. Let's not jeopardize that now. Finally, the governor has clearly stated multiple times he does not want controversial policy to run with fiscal bills.
This bill includes the entire House policy bill. Because this bill contains controversial policy provisions, I will highlight those I cannot support in their current form. The civics test, the reporting specifically, is not acceptable. I continue to oppose requirements that students take a naturalization test, which dumbs down our social studies standards. If it's a civics test we want, then let's give them the academic rigor of all our other tests. Until it's a real civics test, I cannot support it, and it must be funded. I have no problem with the credit in high school as long as it does not creep into the already crowded field of graduation requirements. Although I appreciate Representative Erickson working with me and my staff on aligning world's best workforce requirements, I believe that this should travel in a separate policy bill. I cannot state strongly enough my opposition to the star rating system, but I appreciate the hard work that Rep. Loon, Chair Loon has taken to align it to our No Child Left Behind work. But it still retains a 0 to 100 percent point scale, which we tried with our waiver in the MMR, which was very confusing to schools. They complained about it, and we took it out. We have an excellent stakeholder group committed to transparent, parent-friendly report cards with summary statements about how the school is performing. Let's let them do their work and trust the process. Just so you know, we worked with thousands of stakeholders on our ESSA plan, held over 300 meetings statewide over a two-year period, and they've done a good job with that. Educators and school administrators have expressed the concern that the new tiered licensing system is not ready for July 1st implementation date, yet this body has refused to delay the implementation. I'm also expressing concern that the tiered licensure system may not put adequately trained teachers in the position to do dyslexia screening because of the lack of requirement for preparations for teachers to actually be prepared in tiers 1 through 3 that was enacted last year. On April 9 and today, the governor sent letters to the Senate and House leadership outlining the parameters that he believes will allow us to achieve a smooth and successful conclusion to this session. In the letters, he states that he cannot support a bill that includes policy, makes cuts to operating budgets of state agencies that were negotiated and enacted last year, or are based on false financial assumptions, which this bill includes all of those things. We have less than a month to go. I cannot support this bill in its current form, and I and my staff stand ready to roll up our sleeves, get to work so we can find agreement and deliver a bill we can all be proud of, which supports our kids and families, and the governor can sign. Thank you, and thank you for your indulgence.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the commissioner, you mentioned taking money out of the tax area. What was Commissioner Bowerly's reaction to that proposal?
It's in her bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you said you wanted it for the education bill. How did she react to that?
Well, I don't know where the money would come from, Mr. Chair and Mr. David.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, you said from the tobacco tax that's in taxes, and you want to move it to education. I'd like to know how Commissioner Bowerly responded to your proposal.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking up ideas over there that I knew that were in her tax proposal. How you decide to increase our target is up to this body and to this legislature and the governor.
Okay, I'll ask her myself.
Okay, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Casilius. Thank you for your wide-ranging comments on various things, some of which I agree with and some of which I don't. First of all, I would like to just maybe mollify you a little bit with the school safety. As you likely know, there is $25 million from Representative Loon's bill that will very likely be in the bonded bill as well for school safety and security. Regarding the civics class and test. First of all, I appreciate your comments on the acceptance of the credit, which I think is a very important provision. Regarding the test, of course, in 2016 we did pass a provision to do a civics test based on the naturalization test, which, by the way, we did correlate with our standards as we chose the questions for that. But that right now is the only basically statewide task we have for civics. And all we're asking, you know, we're not trying to put it at the level of the MCAs or anything like that. We're just saying, okay, of the seniors that graduate, how many took the test and what percent graduated? I don't think that that should be that odorous of a provision. That said, I do appreciate the fact, Commissioner, that you and I are going to be meeting tomorrow morning and we can discuss this further.
Commissioner, any comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdo, I look forward to working with you on it so we can find a compromise.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Commissioner, thank you for your comments. You said a lot of things in a very short period of time, and one of the things that really jumped out at me had to do with lead in water in schools. Mm-hmm. And I think you said that the bill doesn't do anything about, well, maybe you could just, actually, I'd kind of like to hear Chair Loon respond to that, because it seemed to me that the commissioner was saying that, you know, there's nothing in here about shutting off the water in school, the water in a drinking fountain when we know it has lead in it. And, you know, I mean, this is a big, big deal. And I'd just like to hear your response to her comments and, you know, maybe clarify, you know, I went by pretty fast and I'm not exactly sure what the bill does or doesn't do around that.
And I guess before you answer, Representative Loon, so, yeah, Commissioner, just so I'm clear, this is a policy provision that you want included in the bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. I'd like to see us strengthen our school water, lead and water policy so that we notify parents and that we remediate. And I think Chair Loon will work with us on that. She's trying to get everybody to agree, and it's just not included in this bill yet. I'm hoping that it will be in the final version.
Okay, and so you're speaking for the governor, and he also wants to have this policy provision in the bill. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. So in the bill, in our budget bill that passed last year, there was a provision that schools are required to test their water, all of their water sources, for lead. And the clock for that starts July 1st of this year. And they are also to make those reports available to parents on what those results are. And so I know there's been a lot of discussion, and this is not an area of my expertise, but with regards to parts per billion of lead that's detected and, you know, what are the there are standards right now, as I understand it, for municipal sources of drinking water, and what would be the standard that schools would try to be required to try to get to with their water sources. Would it be different than the municipal source, which is, I assume, where most schools get their water, is the city that they're in or locality, but it could be different sources and what that would be. So those discussions are ongoing, but there is in place a requirement that schools have to test, and they have to report those tests so that parents know what it is.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Loon, for that. You know, of course, the schools may have lead pipes. That's probably so. You can't assume that the municipal water is the same as what they're getting in the drinking fountain. And I just want to say, boy, if our kids are getting lead in their water at school, I mean, we're spending a lot of money in education. We all want our kids to learn. And if we're letting them get poisoned at school, I mean, it just really jumped out at me. And I hope we can just take that as an emergency issue and deal with it.
Representative Loon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Liebling, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think the schools do need to test, and then you need to report the results of those tests to parents. They have every right to know. And so, again, that was in the legislation that was signed into law last year. And again, there are discussions ongoing about, that sort of builds upon that. I don't think we were at a point before our markup that any consensus was reached on some key points to that process.
Commissioner Casillas.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just to clarify, the governor does want policy to run separate, and so he'd prefer to see it in the policy bill, but because this is shared into the finance bill and tagged onto the finance bill, you have the policy and the finance together. And then secondly, they're only, school districts are only required to make it available to parents. They're not required to actively tell parents. So they could just put it on some website somewhere or upon request provide it, which I don't think is good enough. I think that schools should have to tell parents if you find something at the water fountain at your school, should actively and directly tell parents it's there if you haven't fixed it or fix it. So I think we're working on trying to get language, and hopefully we'll have compromise language that can be included in a final policy bill if it runs separately, or in this bill if it's going to be all put together.
Okay, I have Representatives Fabian, Davids, Draskowski, and Anderson. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As many of you know, I spent 35 years in the classroom. My kids went to school where I was teaching. The administrator's children went to school there. The school board's children were going to school there. I'm very familiar with many, many schools in my district. I know how intimately involved parents are in local school districts. I appreciate the work that was done last year with regards to lead. But, Chair Loon, I have to ask you, and possibly Commissioner, is there anything currently that is going to prevent a school district from caring about their kids and doing the testing and reporting themselves? I have great confidence in local school boards and administrators and teachers and parents to be actively involved in their schools. Is the dog chasing his tail here, and his tail's been cropped? Help me out, Chair Loon.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. No, I have confidence in our schools as well. And, again, I think, you know, they are required to test. They will have to test. They do have to make those tests available to parents so parents know. And I think schools know that they better be communicating with parents if there's a result that is not a healthy one about what they're doing to remediate the situation. Any school that I have interacted with would be taking this seriously and doing everything in their power to rectify that situation and to make sure that the parents and the community was informed.
Representative Pippen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to restate, I just think that local school boards do a great job of taking care of all kinds of things in their schools, and I think that their number one priority is kids and the health of their kids, and I just, for the life of me, cannot imagine the people that I know who are running our local schools doing anything that would even come close to somehow not reporting and not taking care of problems.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a bit confused here, but that's really nothing new. Let me get this right. I don't put words in your mouth. You, Commissioner, you want this policy, education policy, in the education finance bill. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, if the bills run together, then the policy that's contained within the fiscal bill, I think, has to be non-controversial policy that everybody agrees on.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, good luck with that. I'll call the governor, but you could just let him know that in the tax area, there won't be any tax policy unless it's in the tax bill. So I can give him a call.
Of course.
Thanks.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of curious. This whole lead thing, I was opposed to that provision when it came, and we continued in any state in the state. I share Representative Fabian's concerns. Our parents and school boards are doing a wonderful job. But given that, we have this law now that we're saddled with, after a school has gone through the testing and determined that they pass the standard, are we continuing to require them to test and report every single year, or how often, when can we shut off the testing? I guess that would be...
Is that to you, Commissioner? Commissioner Cecilius.
For either of the two.
Mr. Chair, and I think it's Representative Fabian.
Draskowski.
Draskowski. The testing is every 5 years currently.
So, Mr. Chair, There we go again. So if it passes now and it's a lead testing situation, it's going to be fine 5 years from now. Why do we continue this? Anyway, I won't belabor the point anymore, but but Nanny State is here very, very strongly, and it's costing our local governments lots of money, and it's removing the power from local decision makers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I was interested in your comments that you're concerned that parents need to be notified if there's a case of something wrong with the water. Do you also feel that way if the school district is required to report to the state on a student's name, on a student's demographics, any disciplinary actions that were taken against that student, the student's parents' names, and so forth? Do you also feel that the parent should be notified that their child's information is being collected for various issues and then reported to the state?
Commissioner Casillas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have strict laws around student collection of data. So where appropriate, students' names are shared, and where not appropriate, they're not. I don't have the law right in front of me on how we follow that, but we do have data practices, experts, and lawyers at the department who monitor data that comes in and out to the department.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Casillas, my question is, do you think that parents should be notified if their child's information from their demographics, disciplinary action, and so forth, that data be collected and then be reported to the state and not your agency?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I think I'd have to go back and look exactly at what data you're asking me about collection in terms of our DERS reporting and our reporting of behavior. I believe that comes to us in aggregate, and we don't have specific data unless it comes in the form of a highly disciplinary, like on appeal. But I can go back and check and get you that information, absolutely.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, what I'm asking about is the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is now asking for school districts to provide disciplinary actions against students, collecting the student's name, collecting the student's demographics, and providing and taking that data then and sending it to the Department of Human Rights where that will sit.
Okay.
So I'm assuming, based upon your concerns expressed earlier, that you would also be concerned about the parents being notified about that as well.
Commissioner Casillas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, to the best of my understanding, the data that was collected is public data on our website that MDHR has received around discipline, and it does not identify students. It's aggregate of percentages of student groups at the school sites.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Casillas, no, this is part of the agreement that the Minnesota Department of Rights is requiring that school districts provide. This is outside of what current law is. This is going to be an additional reporting that the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is requesting, but I can share that information with you later.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the moms and dads watching us on TV, I want them to know that not every member of the legislature minimizes the effect of lead on children. Most of us know that lead costs IQ points, and it costs our economy, and the numbers are huge. The Department of Health has done a study, which I will bring to the floor, so we can have another conversation about this. And I'm just protesting this notion that kids are not important enough to protect them. So we have school safety in the bill on one hand, and on the other hand we're saying, oh, but if it's lead, kids don't need to be safe. And I say that particularly because all of us sitting here get clean bottled water to drink every day, but we're not providing it for our kids. Shame on us.
Well, Representative Guinness, I'm not sure that I heard anyone here say that they felt that having lead in children's water was okay. I guess I didn't hear that. If someone feels differently, I invite them to speak up. Okay, I don't see any other
Mr. Chairman,
discussion.
Mr.
Representative
Chairman,
Davids.
To Wagenius' point, who said anything about minimizing children or supporting lead in their water? Who said that?
Do you want to respond, Representative Wagenius?
I think as we were saying, oh, my gosh, this is policy. We can't talk about policy. Or yes, we can talk about policy. We were minimizing. So I just want to make sure that we actually are elevating this issue and saying, yes, we are going to address it because this is a bill that has safety in it. So let's make sure that whether the safety is in this bill or another bill, that lead is something we need to deal with.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, nobody was minimizing lead. The governor keeps sending me letters saying keep policy out of finance bills, and I'm not going to do it, first of all, because they go together. Okay? So how you can extrapolate from anything that was said by anybody here that anybody supports lead in children's water is outrageous.
Oh, it's not.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Casilius. Are you aware of any school building in the state that currently has unsafe levels of lead that children have access to either to drink or for non-potable uses?
Commissioner Casilius.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, I am aware of a school. I know that they do flushing every day, which is a regular practice of many of our older buildings where they flush the water, but that's dependent on humans, and humans make errors. And so this is just a way to, quite honestly, I didn't expect this kind of debate, and I appreciate the debate that we're having around school lead and water. And my goal here is basically that our schools are testing their water, that children don't drink it accidentally or otherwise, that it's shut off or remediated and fixed if the school can't afford to fix it, because we have a lot of facility issues in our schools and maintenance projects, or that parents are notified so that they could provide bottled water for their child when they go to school. That's simply all I'm asking. I don't think that that's something any of us would disagree with. And just making the results available, sometimes I can't even find school achievement on a school's website or the principal's name. And sometimes parents don't have access to websites, especially or internet. And so I know it maybe works in small rural communities, but where you have 35,000, 50,000 students in a school district, it may be much more challenging if it's not an active notification.
Representative Dean.
And Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, we all share that. And after, I think, nationally, the conversation about lead in water and its effects on children is one that has not only reached popular knowledge, consensus, but also had time to enact itself in legislation. And I know that in my house I have a well. Zachman's is a great local place. They test my water for lead. It's super cheap. So if you are in opposition to this bill because you say that we are currently not communicating with parents about unsafe lead levels, that's something that could be done very, very cheaply at the school district level that you're currently not doing, but you're saying that we can't move forward with this bill because we're not doing. And you're also saying that you know of some buildings that do have unsafe levels of lead and others that do not. Shouldn't that be more important than lots of other things that you are currently spending money on at the local level?
Commissioner Casilius.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, we have a lot of facility needs, and these decisions are made at the local level. We already have a testing requirement. I'm simply requesting that in this bill that we address shutting it off, covering it with plastic, remediating the problem and notifying parents. And I don't make the decision whether the bill gets signed or not. That's up to the governor. And we decide we all decide what's controversial or not controversial. Currently, it's not in the bill. I'm acknowledging that it's not in the bill and that it's a huge concern to me and many others that it's not in the bill. Chair Loon has worked with us and has expressed an interest in continuing to work with us and stakeholders. I didn't expect for it to get this lively of a discussion. I'm not accusing anybody of not caring about kids or wanting them to drink lead water. I was simply pointing it out. And absolutely, there are a lot of priorities for our schools and funding. As I stated, we have a $329 million surplus. We're spending less than 10% on our kids. We could do more, and we could do better. That's just what I was trying to say.
Thank you, Commissioner Casilius. I was not even aware that this was an issue until you brought it up. You said that currently children are drinking lead water with lead of unsafe levels, and we're not communicating that, and that needs to be fixed with this bill. That's something new to me that I didn't know existed, so that wasn't something that was brought up before. That's something that you brought up in this committee at this time, and that's why we're responding to it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I didn't say children were drinking it. I said that you asked me, are there buildings that have lead in them, and that answer is yes, but they have flushing that they do. Well, if your head custodian is gone and then you have a sub, it's possible that the flushing wouldn't happen. I'm just saying that you could introduce human error. All I'm asking for is that it would be shut off so that our children are not exposed and do not accidentally drink. I don't think any teacher or principal or school superintendent or school board would intentionally have kids drinking lead in the water. They may think that they're notifying and putting it up, but so many parents don't go to those websites, wouldn't see it, maybe miss the flyer. I just think we could be much more intentional around it.
Okay, I don't see any other questions for the commissioner. So, Commissioner, thank you for your testimony. We have one other testifier for this bill, and that's Erica Moss, if she would come forward. Ms. Moss, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Erica Moss. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Close Gaps by Five. And I'll be brief, but I appreciate the opportunity to testify tonight. So we're an early education advocacy nonprofit focused on using early learning to close opportunity and achievement gaps that plague Minnesota's communities, families, and economy. We use four things that research says we must do to close achievement gaps to evaluate policy proposals. First, Mr. Chair and members, start early in life. Second, target limited resources to the most vulnerable. And third, demand quality and keep it flexible. And I would just like to let the committee know today that early learning scholarships are a policy that meet these four criteria and were specifically designed to do so. The problem with scholarships is there are about 35,000 children unable to receive them. We appreciate support from Governor Dayton, bipartisan leaders, including Representative Loon, over the years in support of this policy, but would point out that the governor's budget contained no new money for scholarships. This legislative session will recommending $50 million more for a universal pre-K program called Voluntary Pre-K here in Minnesota. We have concerns with that policy that we stated in the Education Committee and other stops along the way that policy unfortunately starts too late in children's lives to really address achievement gaps and with a schedule typically of 2 to 3 hours per day for 9 months offers too little help. That policy, as opposed to scholarships, also is inflexible, offering not as much choice to parents. So in summary, we'd just like the committee to know that well-intentioned policy may fall short in terms of addressing achievement gaps, and we would urge state leaders to invest as much as possible in scholarships as the process advances and if there are opportunities for the target to grow. Economists like Art Rolnick, who's on my board, and others stress that early investments are a tremendous offer, the public investors a tremendous opportunity for return, but only if those investments are made wisely. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Erica Moss? All right. Thank you, Ms. Moss. I think what I'd like to do at this point is then, since we are done with amendments on this bill that were introduced, we have the higher ed bill, and I'd like to then take the higher ed bill as amended amended onto this bill, and then we'll take Commissioner Pogemiller, who wants to testify on that bill. And so at this time, I would move that House File 3638, as amended, be amended on to House File 4328. Is there any discussion to that procedural amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. House File 3638, as amended, is amended on to House File 4328. Okay. Commissioner Pogemiller, if you could come forward. It's a marriage. Commissioner Pogemiller, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Really appreciate it. I believe there's a letter that we've provided to the committee. I want to thank the Higher Ed Division, the Higher Ed Committee, and Representative Nordness for his courtesy and his staff. As always, it was a pleasure working with them. First, just want to mention various policy items that help implement programs for teachers, borrowers, and public and private institutions are included in the bill, and we appreciate that. They're all in accordance with what the governor recommends. Particularly what special on finance, there's a special revenue account for the spinal cord and traumatic injury research dollars that the legislature has funded. That's a wise decision, and appreciate that. The amendment you add tonight, this evening, moving money to MnState for campus support and a modest amount for holding tuition out at the university. That direction the governor absolutely supports and appreciates that movement. Obviously, the dollars are not at the level he was suggesting and hopes you will give consideration to moving any further. Finally, two smaller items that could be helpful. The first is there's a program that MnState is working on at four of their institutions called Minnesota Reconnect, which is for over 25 returning adults to finish their studies. They already have 15 credits, but they now find themselves in a position where they could use some additional credits, get a certificate or degree, and that would help them in their work environment. This is something that the Lumina Foundation has granted about $750,000 over 3 years to MnState for. And we had suggested, and I believe MnState supports, redirecting money from the Occupational Scholarship Program that is unused, $1.3 million. It's not going to be expended, and redirecting it for this Connect program. And we would hope that as the bill proceeds, consideration will be given to that. It's best practice research that Lumina has funded, and MnState has actually already started to try to hire the staff people that would implement this. So that could really... it would add money to the $750 that they already got from Lumina to do more and better work for about 500 returning adults. One other item then is the governor wants to point out that he's disappointed that the Pell Grant fill-in for Minnesota Dreamers is not included in the bill. He had recommended that last year, the year before, and this year. And again, that would help about 568 students realize their dream of a college education, Minnesota Dreamers. Mr. Chairman, that's it. Again, Representative Nornison's committee are a joy to work with, and we appreciate the support in the bill.
Any questions for Commissioner Pogemiller? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, members, and Mr. Chairman.
Okay, members, the bill is before us as amended. Other discussion to the bill? Okay, I see no further discussion. So members, Chair Loon renews her motion that House File 4328, as amended, be referred to the General Register and that staff may make any technical corrections necessary to either House File 3638 that was previously amended as well as House File 4328 to reflect the will of the committee. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 4328, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Members, for tomorrow, it would be my expectation that it would be much the same as today, that we would have Democratic and Republican huddles after the session adjourns, and then that we would meet to take up the legacy bill and the public safety bill. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if you had any idea when the education bill would be before the full House.
That, Representative Carlson, I don't have an answer to. Representative Loon, do you know what the schedule is for the Education Committee being on the floor?
Mr. Chair, I think the end of this week, maybe Thursday, but I couldn't say definitively until we get that signal.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Markworth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Chair Davids, if I could have us. I know tomorrow also we have a tax committee that will be meeting during the day, and there's a number of members on both, and normally it doesn't matter that much. I shouldn't say that. But there's going to be votes being taken in each of those, so I just hope that the chairs would be able to work that out so that we can properly attend both.
Yes, and Representative Markwart, we have talked about that, and I think we will be able to coordinate it so at least there's no conflict in voting.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Representative Davis, do you have anything to add?
Well, no, that's exactly correct, and Representative Markwart asked a very good question because we will be kind of going at the same time. I'm thinking when votes are going on here, we'll be taking public testimony in taxes, and we would not vote anything in taxes until we had notified folks in Ways and Means that they'd get over there quick.
And I guess I would say, too, Representative Markford, I mean, we'll have to see what the schedule is like. I mean, I'd like to be there for the testimony, too, if I could, as I'm sure other members would. But we'll just have to see, you know, how much time everything takes in the floor tomorrow and such as we're figuring out the exact schedule afterwards, too. Representative Carlson.
I was just wondering if Representative Davids plans on meeting more than 17 minutes.
I suspect the answer is yes, but Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Last Thursday, Mr. Chairman.
And to Representative Carlson, if I can go 15, I'll go 15.
Well, I was at that meeting, Representative Carlson, and there weren't many questions asked. It did go very quickly. Seeing no other questions, members, we are adjourned.
I was blocked. Yes.
I got there.
Yeah.
I got there.
See, I have that group.
Oh, yeah. You have from the